Okay, thank you very much. Do we have a pointer of some sort? All right. I've added Larry Taylor to my talk because I begin, as Jack Schmidt did, I've used some of his slides in my talk. And so he was invited to come to this meeting but could not come because of conflicts. But he is one of the world's experts in this whole topic of lunar regolith. Thank you. Next, please. Let's see, how do I do this? Okay. We have been to the moon on Apollo, of course, all those times. And we also have sample from the robotic Russian sample return mission. So we have 9 sets of samples from places that we know. In addition, we have about close to 20 meteorites now from the moon, and they're from other places, possibly from the backside. The problem is we don't know exactly where they're from. We've heard a lot of this already in Jack Schmidt's talk. We're talking about the loose fragmental material originally defined by Shoemaker. And I think I'd like to see lunar dust term confined to material less than 20 micrometers. This is kind of a cutoff that we've used throughout the lunar program. And we have a sieve fraction right at 20 micrometers. So there's a lot of data on the material below 20 micrometers. It's a good working definition of dust. We've heard a little bit about the composition, the chemistry. This is roughly the chemistry of the average lunar soil, kind of combination of Maori and Highland soil. Interesting things are some of the metals. There's a fair amount of bizarre metals in lunar soil, but there's not much in the way of heavy toxic metals. Okay. The moon, again, a Larry Taylor slide. The moon is bombarded, as we know, with all kinds of bad things, bad for the moon. But meteorite impact is, of course, the main process that we see in terms of the creation and modification of lunar dust. Next slide, please. And this is a slide that we saw earlier. And it simply shows a lot of the detailed processing that goes on at the finer soil forming scale. Vaporization turns out to be a fairly major process, vaporization and condensation. We didn't know this for many years. It was only after about 20 years of study that it became clear that this was a fairly major process at the micro-nano scale. Next, please. This is a summary of the processes that we see here, mostly related to meteorite impact, a few related to particulate impact from the solar wind and solar flares. A lot is going on there. The time scale is quite different from what we're used to on Earth, but there's the lunar soil is a very complex an active area. Next, please. This simply shows the typical particles in a fairly coarse size range. Now, I'd like to point out that these particles have been carefully washed. If you simply got these particles out of the rock box and looked at them, you could barely tell one from the other because they'd be totally covered with dust. And the only way you see the rocks, this the small particles is to wash them off with, in those days we used liquid freon, and now we use acetone or alcohol. Next, please. Agglutinates are a very important particle on the moon. We don't have any agglutinates on the Earth. And in fact, agglutinates are the main difference between any soil on the moon and any soil on Earth. Agglutinates are simply made by small-scale impact that welds and cements together small particles with glass. But keep in mind that we have no Earth equivalent. Next, please. Another thing about agglutinates is they often have really sharp corners. They have reentrant angles, they have arms that stick out, they have little hooks like Velcro, and these are big ones here, but the same shape holds all the way down to the dust size fraction. They're very jagged and very often very full of reentrant angles. Next, please. The concept of soil maturity is one that you need to realize it is important because it's a basis of understanding how one soil differs from another soil on the moon. It's basically a record of the exposure of the lunar soil over time. And the most mature lunar soils have been actually dated to have been exposed very near the surface for on the order of 100 million years. That's roughly the time it takes to get mature. Now, much longer than that, the soils tend to be gardened into a deeper depth, and so they're no longer exposed to the intense weathering right at the surface. So we don't have 3 billion year old soils, although the surface itself has been exposed for 3 to 4 billion years, simply because older soils are gardened into a depth and covered up. Next, please. I'll talk a little bit about grain size now. Grain size distribution, lunar soils are rather poorly sorted by any terrestrial standard, simply because there's no good sorting mechanism on the moon. Next, please. As soils mature, as they get ground up, the mean grain size decreases, the agglutinate abundance goes up, the shape of the distribution changes, it becomes narrower, the standard deviation becomes less, and sometimes a skewness or kurtosis in the grain size distribution develops. And that is, there's a lot of data on these grain size parameters in the literature, and there's also a catalog of grain size distributions that some of you have seen. I can give you the reference of that later. Next, please. This diagram was really the first diagram that more or less defined the maturity in terms of grain size and agglutinate content. And these are the most mature soils here. These are all Apollo 17 soils, I believe. you can see that the agglutinate content goes up as the grain size goes down. There's a class here of the orange and black glass that Jack was talking about here. And these materials are very interesting because they're extremely immature. They've had almost no reworking, and yet they're the finest soils on the surface of the moon that we know about. And the reason is that they're not formed by the normal soil-forming processes. They were formed as volcanic ash in a volcanic eruption 3.5 billion years ago. And they have a very, very fine grain size. Why is that important? Because I think I'll mention later that they may be our best oxygen ore. That may be where we'll go when we want to mine the moon for oxygen And I've advocated that for a long time, that these would be excellent oxygen resources. Next, please. Again, this simply shows the fairly nice relationship between agglutinate percentages and the grain size. These are volume percentages in the 90 to 150 micrometer size fraction, and they can get up to as high as 60%. More than half of the lunar soil by volume, in some cases, is made up of agglutinates. Next, please. Listen, these are some typical size distribution curves. This is our Apollo 17 soils, immature, submature, and mature. And this is the orange grass here. You can see it has a very skinny standard deviation, whereas immature soil has a very wide, broad standard deviation. Plus, this one happens to be bimodal as well. Now, what happens here? Let's look at immature, submature, mature. What happens here? Essentially, if you start with a single impact, you get something like this. Or this is a basalt ejecta from a nuclear explosion. And this is what you get with most of the material in the core size fraction. Then as you grind it up, you move particles from these bins here to the finer bins. And eventually, you should end up with something like this if you grind it long enough, with the finest bin having the most material. In fact, you don't. And one reason that you don't is that you make agglutinates, which soak up the finest particles. So rather than this, you get something like this. This is the mature size distribution. And the mean grain size is on the order of 50 micrometers. Next, please. People have been able to reproduce that in the laboratory to some degree. Next, please. This is some work that was done by Fred Hertz at JSC and his friends. And essentially, they start with some basalt, and they shoot hypervelocity impacts at it. And what happens is that it slowly, after the first few impacts, it looks like this with most of the stuff in the coarser size fraction. And after 200 impacts, it's like that. Well, that size distribution would still be, in lunar terms, a very immature size distribution. Even though it's been impacted 200 times, it's nowhere near the size distribution of a mature soil. So that tells us that the mature soils on the moon have been impacted many, probably orders of magnitude more than 200 times to get to their present distribution. That's really hard to produce in the laboratory in a systematic way. Next, please. Again, the size distribution that we saw was closest to something like this, or maybe this. This is probably the most immature soil in the Apollo collection here. And we were sort of approaching this with that experimental data. Next, please. One interesting thing, once you start to understand how the regolith works, there's kind of a logical system going on here that makes sense. And one interesting observation is that if you look at the finest grain size soil at each site, the most mature soil at each site, and you plot that against the regolith depth determined by other means, geophysics or photo interpretation and so forth, there appears to be a fairly systematic trend such that the finest soils are associated with the thickest regolith. And that's logical. But what is not logical is how systematic it seems to be. And in fact, that gives us the ability to predict grain size from orbit. if we can determine regolith thicknesses by photo interpretation or by radar and so forth, if you can determine that and tell me what that number is, I can predict the grain size of the soil at that point on the moon. That could be handy when we talk about the hazards of lunar dust. Next, please. And this is, again, one that Jack showed, in which as the soils mature, the agglutinates build up, and we've seen this before. But what is interesting is first the mineral fragments build up, and then they trail off. They reach a peak here at an intermediate size range intermediate maturity of somewhat submature. Meantime, the rock fragments, the basalt fragments, keep going down. And this is logical once you think about it, because as you bust up the salts, you get minerals, and then the mineral fragments get soaked up into the agglutinates. And where this peak actually occurs is not very well known, but it may be important when we want to understand what minerals are present and as a function of maturity. Next, please. Well, let's look at some of these soil particles here. This is a regolith breccia, which is essentially, some regolith breccias are basically shock compressed loose soil, maybe sintered a bit by heat of impact. This is a bit of an agglutinate here. You can see glass holding these particles together. And one thing that you probably already noticed is how many sharp corners there are and spiky protuberances. Next, please. Another regolith breccia with a broken agglutinate. And these are essentially whole agglutinates down here. And again, the grain size is, the finest grain size is certainly dominant, but it's got an awful lot of sharp grains in it. Next, please. Comparison, this is our simulant JFC1. We'll hear talk about this a little bit later, but we're able in JFC1 to reproduce a lot of these sharp grains and agglutinate-like things. These are vesicular glass particles from a volcanic eruption that form this simulant soil. There's a fair amount of similarity, but we don't have the complex reentrant shapes of agglutinates that do this simulant. Next, please. We simply dumped a little soil on a glass slide and looked at it with an optical microscope, and this is what it looks like. This is that square blown up, and this is basically the dust fraction. I can see agglutinates here. There's one there. There's one there. There's a glassy part of a glutinate with a feldspar grain. Next, please. What about the shapes of these grains? Well, they tend to be more equant, although there are elongated grains or fibers, but they're fairly rare. And agglutinates, as I said before, are the unusual, peculiar grains here. Next, please. This is from 10084, which is a fairly mature Mari soil. These are the grain sizes that we're looking at with an optical microscope. These are polished thin sections with a polarizing microscope. And here you can see, in this grain size here, a number of agglutinates with very sharp features here. And a few crystals of feldspar. And notice that the coarser material is all rock fragments. I don't see any agglutinates in there, although this is a breccia fragment, which does have a bit of an agglutinate in it. Next, please. This is a This is a more mature highland soil now as opposed to a Maori soil. And again, the coarser material is mainly rock fragments. And then as we get somewhat finer, we get to glass and big minerals. And that's an agglutinate there and a sphere. Next, please. Let's look at a few individual grains. This is a big grain, which I think is a pyroxene. Fairly rugged looking. Next, please. As we go up to higher magnification, we see a lot of grains that are very irregular, somewhat elongated. And one interesting thing is that they're always, almost always, little grains on top of big grains, which are either electrostatically attached or van der Waals attached or even thermally welded. But it's very common to see little grains on top of bigger ones. Next, please. This is one of the most elongated grains that we had in these recent photos. It's about 3 or 4 microns wide and maybe 10 to 15 long. And it's a calcium aluminum, calcium iron magnesium silicate. Next, please. A few more equally equant grains here, but even these equant grains have little sharp points sticking out. 1 micron scale bar. Next, please. Now we'll go up to some higher magnification. 1 micrometer here. All these grains are smaller than 1 micron, and many of them are a tenth or even smaller than a tenth. These are all these specks are real lunar grains. By volume or by mass, they don't make up much of the sample, but there's sure a lot of them. Next, please. Jack talked about the orange and black glass. This is a new photo that we have of the orange glass. This is actually from a core that went down half a meter or so for drive to. These are little glass spheres, and some of them are black because of crystallized glass. And many of them, if not most of them, are broken. There are only a few real spheres left, and presumably they got broken in a fairly violent pyroclastic volcanic eruption. Next, please. These are the coarser ones, which are not as broken up. The interesting thing is that these were not broken necessarily by impacts because they don't have any real maturity. They're incredibly immature. So they've not been smashed up by impacts, and the fact that they are smashed up suggests a fairly violent eruption. Next, please. All right, grain surfaces. We've talked about sizes and shapes. There's a lot going on the surface of these grains. Vapor deposits, unsatisfied reactive bonds from fracturing in high vacuum. We talked a little bit about that earlier. Sputtering, implantation. All lunar material is highly reduced compared to Earth material. All lunar material has reduced iron in it, metallic iron in it. Conversely, there's no oxidized +3 iron in natural lunar material. And it's all highly dry compared to any terrestrial soil we know. Those things added together may make for some really different properties in situ lunar dust. Next, please. This is just a poster that we gave at the Lunar Planetary Science Conference. A couple weeks ago, and I'll show you a few pictures up close. Next, please. This is a surface of a grain. It shows two features. One is this kind of rounding of a cleavage steps is probably because it results from sputtering, solar flare sputtering. And then these are pancakes that have been splashed onto the surface at while still molten. This is a hypervelocity impact crater. And these are, there are a few little grains that are just attached loosely to the surface. Next, please. Another impact, these impacts are really common, and they go down to, this one is about 100 nanometers in diameter. There's one there that is no more than 50 nanometers in diameter. That's a 50 nanometer crater. That was made by something that had to be smaller than 50 nanometers across, and probably just a few dozen atoms could have made that. There are little tiny particles here, which are on the order of 20 to 30 nanometers in diameter, which are probably glassy. Next, please. This is a somewhat more intensely space-weathered surface. Again, some hint of sputtering, and then covered with little pancakes of different sizes. Sometimes the pancakes had cooled and they're not as flat as others. And then there are a few detrital grains that are attached to the surface. All these grains that you see are sub-micron. Next, please. Another surface that has just a variety of pancakes and accretionary particles, a few big pancakes that are several microns in diameter. Next, please. And then this is an area that we think was heavily ion etched, sputtered by solar wind, and it brings out these sputter features, which are related to the crystallographic directions of the pyroxene, which was sputtered. Next, please. Again, this is one that Jack showed, showing the development of a rim of either vapor deposited and sputter deposited material on a plagioclase, and there's iron in that rim. That iron came from somewhere else, not from the plagioclase, and it is that submicron iron that is one of our concerns for these tiny particles. Next, please. When that iron that develops on the surface is melted into an agglutinate, it essentially forms a three-dimensional network of metallic iron, like a cloud of stars here. This is a cloud of metallic iron going down to just a few nanometers in diameter. This is highly reduced, possibly reactive metallic iron. Next, please. Mean grain size here is on the order of 100 to 150 angstroms. Next, please. This is a point that Larry Taylor makes over and over again. Soils are different from the rocks because the soils have 10 times as much metallic iron in them. It's a very unusual situation. Soils are not just ground up rocks. Because of these processes, they develop this whole volume correlated, first surface correlated, and then volume correlated abundance of metallic iron. Next, please. We're going to hear a talk about simulants a little bit later, but I want to point out that simulants are good for some things. They can reproduce the bulk chemistry, the grain size, the minerals and mineral types in glasses, and some of the jagged shapes. But, next please, they cannot produce the agglutinate shapes, the fine grain reduced iron we talked about, the reflectance spectral properties, which is dominated by those fine grain iron particles. They cannot produce easily the implanted species, and reactive radiation damaged rims and vapor deposits, which can be reactive as well. For example, on that orange and black glass, we know that there are deposits of sulfur-containing compounds, and there are deposits of zinc-containing compounds, which are very reactive, which in the Houston humidity will convert quickly to something else. So we think that there are reactive vapor deposits that we just haven't had a chance to study because they've all been exposed to some terrestrial atmosphere. Next, please. Next. This is, again, one that Larry Taylor provided. Next, please. We've talked about this. Next, please. And Jack talked about this. When we talk about management of dust, magnetic attraction is one way that you can start to control dust. Next, please. And this sums up the lunar soil, the space weathering, all the things that I've been talking about, and going from coarse to fine. You build up these unusual features that we just don't find in terrestrial soils. Next, please. These are, as I see it, some key questions. Can the human system clear out the unusual shape of the glutenates, and what about the 1/6 gravity? What effect does that have? Incidentally, most terrestrial dust, natural dust, most dust consists of clay minerals, micron, submicron clay minerals, except for a few cases like ground up quartz that gives us problems with silicosis, or ground up asbestos particles. Most natural dust consists of clay minerals. There are no clay minerals on the moon, not one. The fine particle, the dust particles, are really quite different from dust particles on Earth. They're silicates, they're oxides, and they're glasses. And so what we've learned about the terrestrial dust may not apply to lunar dust. So then there's this whole business of reactive bonds, unsatisfied bonds, radiation damage, vapor, active vapor deposition, and sputter products. And then we have to worry about the simulants, that what simulants are good for what kinds of tests. Next, please. Now, I think everyone involved in the new vision thinks of something like this at some point, in which we're actually living, not only living on the moon, but doing something useful like producing oxygen or producing hydrogen. And this is just an artist's conception of how those things might occur. And next, please. Well, I'm going to quit at that. Thank you very much. Lunar soil is very susceptible to charging, and I think mainly because it's so dry. Plus these unsatisfied bonds means that it's easily charged just through tribal electric effects. And I've worked a lot with lunar soil in the lab, and it's very difficult to clean off of surfaces. And I have, whenever I work in a clean bench, I have a de-staticking device there to discharge the static electricity. Otherwise, it just sticks to everything. It doesn't stick to conductors, but it sticks to plastic or glass. So. So it is. It could be a major problem, and one of the countermeasures might be some kind of electrostatic charging device.
The grain size data you showed, is that on a percentage mass basis?
Yes, it is. Those are all percentage mass, weight percent mass. Well, it's weight, but it's really mass.
And when you describe a process where you plot finer materials off of coarser materials,
yeah,
do you save that wash?
Say that again, please.
When you wash the finer,
yeah,
materials, do you save the wash?
We saved the wash. We have sacks of washed waste wash, we call it. Dry, but we turn it back into the curator. If you want some, you can request it, and they'll be happy to give it to you, I'm sure, because it's not good for much else.
I was wondering about the impact, some of the impacts that you showed that were sub-micron size. How would that affect people down there if they would be impacted with those?
That's a problem that a lot of people have thought about, and there are micrometeoroid bumpers on the space station, for example. I think during spacewalks, it's considered so unlikely that one large enough to penetrate the suit would hit that they don't worry about it much. And if those submicron craters formed on your suit, you probably wouldn't even know it, so that's not a problem either. But yeah, over a long period of time, you have to have meteoroid protection.
I don't think there's ever been a documented case of an impact on a suit, right?
Not that I know of.
I didn't look at pretty carefully.
The shuttle windows have had a number of impacts, and I've studied some of those. If it's big enough that they're starting to get a little fracturing, they don't fly it again. They take it out and they core it out. And I've looked at the cores of shuttle windows, and indeed, many of them are hypervelocity impacts of meteoroids. And you can tell by the chemistry in the residue what caused them. And they can make very, very nice craters in the windows, but they never cratered through or cracked through. That's a good question that we're having hot debates about. if there is water there, is it like permafrost? Has it glued together the grains into a block, or is the ice itself comminuted and ground up so that you get little a regolith of ice particles? Those are kind of the two extremes, or is it there's a lot of heat every time a meteorite hits? Does that heat melt the ice and cause it to flow and glue stuff together? We don't have a clue, and that's a subject of experimentation right now that we have to figure out. At least the boundaries, at least the worst case as far as hard ice permafrost, versus the best case for operation at least, where it is loose grains of ice mixed in with the silicates. Yeah?
What's the pH and pH of the loose model? So the concept works?
Yeah, well, you have to add water to it, and I've never done that. And there are people that have done it, and I'm trying to remember the data. Carl, do you know the?
I don't know.
People have done it in terms for raising crops and testing toxicity. I don't think it's too far from neutral, but it's probably on the acid side of a couple of units.
About the EH,
I just don't know.
Well,
yeah, it's got so much metallic iron, it would be.
Well,
reducing plus the hydrogen plus the carbon. There's apparently carbon either as graphite or simple carbon compounds. I can't give you the exact percentages, but the amorphous material goes up fairly strongly, sort of the 1 micron range. The less than 20 to 10 and 10 to 5 to 1, I think the minerals are still dominating, mainly feldspar and pyroxene, but glass has overtaken them, and pure amorphous material, I would guess, is dominating in some micron.
Okay, well, we